Hi, Emily.
Hi, Sarah.
How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. How are you?
Good. I'm Sarah Posner. I'm senior editor at Religion Dispatches, and my guest today is Emily Hauser. Emily blogs about Israel-Palestine on Open Zion, which is a blog at the Daily Beast that's edited by Peter Beinart. She's an American Israeli, a member of a conservative synagogue outside of Chicago, and she's studied and written about the Israel-Palestine conflict for 25 years or so. And she also maintains her own blog, and she's on Twitter, where you can find her frequently discussing these and other matters. Today we are going to be talking about, surprise, surprise, Israel-Palestine. So I wanted to start, Emily, with your own biography, which I for some time have found really fascinating, because I think that it sets a, it lays out a very different narrative than I think a lot of people expect or have come to expect. So I was wondering if maybe you could share that. I know you've written about it at the Daily Beast in a post called Dear Israel, This Is Why I Left. But if you could share it with
absolutely.
Us so that everyone can better understand where it is you're coming from.
Sure. It starts at a kind of an unusual place that it's a funny thing. I'd rather not talk about the fact that I'm a convert because I don't feel like a convert. I feel like a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of my conversion becomes material at various points in my story and my philosophy and my relationship with the various communities. So it has to come up now and then. I went to Israel for the first time in 1982 and initially in a year off between high school and college and initially fell in love with the country and then, like a lot of young girls do, fell in love with a boy. And I wound up, you know, going back and then staying and then staying, you know, semester, special semester after special semester. The first was with my was with St. Olaf College, just like Betty White. So I wound up taking this, I guess Betty White didn't, but her character did. But I wound up taking this unusual academic path from St. Olaf College to Tel Aviv University. And after having spent X amount of time there, decided to convert, but which was for me more a statement of acknowledging who I was, not doing something new. And in fact, there's this little.
And you converted, I assume, from a Christian denomination?
From Protestant Christianity, mm-hmm. Broadly speaking. there's this little bit of insight into rabbinical courts with the way that I wound up being converted in that, you have to go and sort of like apply. Will you consider me for conversion? And when they say yes, they send you to study. And most people who apply for conversion get sent to conversion ulpan, that's a place where they assume you know nothing. And I was sent to a special school for people who were secular but were taking on greater religious observance rather than the, you know, typical conversion ulpan. So there was this acknowledgement that I was already on board. I just kind of needed the process, what amounts to a legal process.
Now, I'm curious, when you went to Israel for the first time, was it just on your own or was it with a tour of some kind?
It was on my own. It was the result of having not been able to go on AFS in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a very good friend who I wanted to visit who was Israeli. And I just took a year off between high school and college. And I happened to have the kind of mom who would say, that's not only is that okay, but that's a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, and it all just, I'm sorry, I just got a fly on my face in the middle of this. It's very informal. and it all just steamrolled from there.
Uh-huh.
There's the theory, of course, that's always nice to bring up this close to the holiday of Shavuot, mm-hmm. that, we were all at Sinai, right? All Jews, past, present, and future, were at Sinai receiving the law. And that's a story that we tell. And in a way that's true to me, in a way that isn't objective and you can't measure it and it doesn't make any sense, but clearly there was something that was drawing me to this place because it immediately became my home in a way that no place else ever has been, including the very lovely home from which I speak right now.
Chicago.
I refer to it as the gentle exile of American suburbia.
So you ended up marrying and Israeli. Is that right?
Right. Mm-hmm. And I always like to point out Jerusalem born and bred. So he's not just an Israeli. He's kind of that elite Israeli. He's from Jerusalem.
So you stayed until when? And when? What made you decide to come back to the States, or not for your husband come back, but come?
Well, I was there for 14 years, all told, mm-hmm. and we had already been married. I converted about a week before I met him, so it had nothing to do with him. And we then lived there for about another 7 years, and we were back in the States for me to get my master's degree, just because I had this sense that I wanted to spend some time as an adult in America. Mm-hmm. There was never any sense that we were going to be staying here or that we wouldn't be raising our family in Israel, particularly for me. And this is where...
Even more so than for your husband.
Yes, mm-hmm. interestingly enough. It's a funny thing. People sometimes say that I must be okay in spite of my politics because I'm married to an Israeli, you know, an Israeli-born Israeli. But he's to the left of me politically and feels a looser attachment than I do.
To Israel.
So, you know, assumptions are always kind of a funny thing. Mm-hmm. But We were here for my master's degree, and I'd had my first child, a boy who's about to become bar mitzvah, and the second intifada had broken out, and we were both so horrified by the violent response of the Israeli public, and I mean the Israeli government, to the intifada, and the sort of general response both amongst the government and the public of just a complete unwillingness to own any of it, to claim any responsibility for it, to take any real steps that would genuinely bring about resolution of the conflict rather than continuation and management of it. That we decided, and it was interesting, it was the only time in our married life that this ever happened, that we came to a big decision on our own without even talking to each other about it first, that we didn't want to raise our children there. Which for me in particular was a very painful decision to make. And I think without wanting to make myself sound, I think it's telling that someone who chose that place, who was not raised to have almost a crush on the Jewish state, right? Mm-hmm. The way that American Jewish kids are raised, who was not ever raised to that kind of reverence and sense of belonging. I chose it of my own free will and found a home that I didn't know I was looking for and had no intention of ever living anywhere else or being anyone else. I think it's telling that in that person's life, the situation became so untenable that I chose not to raise my children there. Mm-hmm. So that's my story in a rather rambling nutshell.
So since you've been back here, so you've been back in the States for 14 years. And
right, as long as I was there, which is kind of symbolic to me.
Mm-hmm, at this moment. But it's right. About to become longer. I mean,
In August it will start becoming longer.
And you still go back for visits, mm-hmm. I take it?
Yep, about every year on average. I mean, there was this one year where we went back like three times, right. And then there were these 2 years we didn't go, right. But yeah, about every year.
So you've also chosen to inject yourself into probably one of the most hot-button issues to discuss, you know, and you've engaged this, you know, through your blog and through writing at Open Zion, and you're very public about your story and also about your objections to the occupation and to the positions of and actions of the Israeli government. How do you find the reaction to that? I mean, I know that from the right, you know, you probably get the predictable reactions from the right that, mm-hmm. you know, you're anti-Israel and anti-anti.
Right, and that I can't say anything because I left.
Ah, okay.
That's a big one. Uh-huh. But the one thing that's important to remember is that my activism on this side of the ocean is a direct continuation of activism that I undertook over there.
Okay.
I, during the first intifada, I have a very clear memory of coming to the realization that there were two options. Either kick all the Palestinians out, you know, kill them and kick them out. Ethnic cleansing, as brutal as you can imagine. or two states. And as I was not going to come down on the side of ethnic cleansing, I had to come down on the side of two states. And it was a decision that I'd clearly been sort of circling for a while. You know, I look at the sorts of things I had done up until that moment in time in the second, in the first intifada. Mm-hmm. But I was absolutely an activist in terms of both, you know, marching in the streets and supporting the particular political parties and particular people and
at that,
all of that.
At that time, at that particular time in Israel, mm-hmm. was it less controversial to engage in that kind of activism than it is to do so here in the States in terms of the reaction that you get from your fellow American Jews?
My impression is that it was and is. I think in a way that makes sense, though, because in the States, I mean, I don't like it, but I understand why American Jews tend to feel more powerfully a need for some sort of unity that I don't think ever existed, but whatever. There's this sense of a need to achieve that. Because when you're in Israel, you've already established yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not, you can't question my bona fides because I'm here.
Right.
Now, the interesting thing is that lately people have been questioning the bona fides of people who are there and have been there and were born there and whose
yep.
parents and grand, you know, whatever.
Yep. We'll get to that in a minute.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. I wanted to try to track whether there were changes there over time in terms of acceptance or toleration of dissenting views, dissenting towards the occupation, dissent towards the, you know, a Likud government, you know, has that over time become less tolerated in Israel?
My impression is that yes, but I don't know that it's, I think that it's a matter of degrees. Maybe it's a good few degrees, but it's a matter of degrees because, you know, when one of the things that has come up a lot, and I know we may be talking about this later, but one of the issues that's been raised surrounding the race riots in southern mm-hmm. South Tel Aviv the other day, was the fact that the women were insulted in very sexual ways. You know, may you be raped by a foreigner was one of the things shouted at the women who were trying to protect
right.
these, you know.
Let's, can
folks.
We backtrack? Because I think that this incident that you're talking about didn't get mm-hmm. a ton of press here.
Well, but what I want to say yes. is I used to have that screamed at me when I, that sort of thing.
Mm.
Only it wasn't a foreigner. It was an Arab. May you be raped by Arabs, or you whore, you sleep with Arabs, or a big
because
one was also you lesbian. You know,
and
I guess it was enough.
This was said to you by.
If I was standing on a street corner demonstrating with women in black or with Peace Now or
mm-hmm,
whatever,
mm-hmm.
It wasn't directed at me personally in any real sense.
Right.
But it was directed at me. Right.
Right.
And it was directed at all of the women. And of course, I had this one really good friend who happened to be lesbian. So she would yell back, I am. Thanks. You know, whatever. But it's that kind of violent. And sexually violent kind of putting down of those who dissent has a history. It's not brand new.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think it's louder now.
Okay.
I think they have more cover in the government. I think they have more cover in society.
Well,
but it's not that it's brand new by any stretch.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that incident that you brought up. Cause like I said, I didn't think it got a ton of press here in the States. And,
mm-hmm.
This was something that escalated into basically a race riot
right.
involving African immigrants living in Israel who've been experiencing a lot of hostility, to say the least. And maybe you can describe a little bit more. There were some very terrible images that were both video and still photos that were taken at that incident. And there was a reporter who was roughed up there. And maybe you can talk about it in a little bit more detail.
Well, what I understand, and of course I'm reading it on this side,
mm-hmm.
Is that windows were broken, stores associated with these immigrants were broken into and ransacked, and a few people were attacked physically. There was a lot of sort of that loud, threatening presence of a mob that at certain points descended into physical violence, whether against places or people. There, as I understand, 11 people were arrested, all of the minors. To me, that doesn't mean very much. It doesn't mean that there weren't more people involved in it, and it doesn't mean that they weren't, that those involved in it were all minors, because the Tel Aviv police are kind of notorious for, at least in my circles, are kind of notorious for not necessarily worrying too much about the needs of the people that they might be supposed to be protecting. That's a rather broad statement, and I'm sure people will argue with it, but that's my sense, that I didn't necessarily want to depend on them to protect me.
So there
were... so it was, you know, people have been describing it as a pogrom. I tend to not want to use that word mm-hmm. because that slams shut ears in the Jewish community.
Yeah, yeah.
But it had a lot of the details of a pogrom, you know, in terms of broken glass and blood and loud mob and police standing by.
So in the immediate aftermath of this incident, there was a huge cry for American Jewish groups to speak out against it. And in fairly short order, there were statements issued from many American Jewish groups decrying what happened and decrying racism in general. But it struck me that that was just like a totally obvious response to what was happening there. I mean, it was such... And I just wonder, you know, does that have any impact at all that, you know, the Anti-Defamation League and a bunch of other American Jewish groups said that it was terrible? I mean, you know, it just sort of seemed rather pro forma to me that, you know.
Well, there's something to that. There's sort of the you don't get a cookie for doing the right thing, right?
I guess, yeah.
To borrow from Chris Rock. But at the same time, the people who have been inflaming this violence are people sitting in government.
Okay.
And the American Jewish community, mm-hmm. you know, they're Miri Regev and Michael Ben-Ari and Danny Danone, who, by the way, is also the guy who, one of the people behind dragging Jeremy Ben-Ami over to be, mm-hmm. to be for a Knesset hearing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The American Jewish community.
Jeremy Ben-Ami, the president of J Street. Just to
right, exactly. Mm-hmm. The American Jewish community has a history of not wanting to openly question the acts of people who are actually sitting in Israel's government.
Right.
There's also another interesting thing. This is so complicated. You know, social issues are never as simple as people want them to believe. People want to believe that they are. There is, of course, a problem when thousands of people are coming across your border, right? That's a problem. No country is comfortable with that. But on the other hand, once they're there, how do you treat them? That's another question. And there's this tendency, apparently across oceans, because we have it in our country as well, to assume that folks who are coming across the border illegally are huge criminals and are responsible for all these terrible acts. And that's the tack that all these people in government and a lot of people involved in the activism and the mob action against these Africans have been taking, that these folks are criminals and they're raping our daughters and they're, you know, robbing us blind and they're taking our work also, of course, right?
Right.
But the fact of the matter is the statistics indicate that Israel police's own statistics show that 2 to 2.5% of the African population is involved in criminal activity versus about 5% of the general population.
Right.
So whereas any crime is a bad thing, they are actually less than half or about half, depending on what month you're looking at, likely to be involved in criminal activity than the general population.
But it's a common trope to use against the outsider. That
right.
They're, you know, that they're,
right.
They bring something foreign and terrible and undermining
right.
to your society
so,
and your way of life.
But I want to make sure I make clear why I brought that up when you were asking about the American organizations.
Mm-hmm.
the American organizations are accepting this line that these African immigrants are this horrible force for criminal activity at face value in their statements. For the most part, there's a sort of an acceptance of this trope.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that really interesting because on the one hand, they're openly questioning this tendency that has been supported by members of the Israeli government. But on the other hand, they're not questioning the basis for it. And you asked me, do I think it will make a difference? I honestly don't know. What worries me, and I don't know if worries is really the right word because it doesn't actually surprise me, but I think it's notable that no one's making the connection between what's happening, at least not out loud, not in public.
Right.
Not making the connection between what's happening to the Africans and the way that Palestinians are treated on a regular basis. No one's drawing that very clear, shining line between if you accept xenophobia and vicious violence on one side of the border, it's going to spill over onto the other side of the border.
Well, I mean, that was kind of what I was trying to get at with my question, mm-hmm. in the sense that you very rarely, if ever, see American Jewish groups or the mainstream American Jewish groups criticizing the Israeli government for its treatment of the Palestinians.
Right.
Yet this seemed kind of perhaps more obvious to American eyes, in part because, there's video documentation of treatment of Palestinians for sure.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I think that there was something about this devolving into this sort of racially motivated mob that maybe could be digested by Americans in a way that American Jews haven't been trained. It's not the right word.
Well, comprehend, also the fact,
because American Jews do not, it's only recently that there's even been this discussion that the occupation is wrong, and that discussion that you have at Open Zion. So it's almost seems like a little proxy, to say, we will take a stand against, racism in Israel, and we will say something about it in this case.
It's important to remember that the ADL back historically, I mean, it hasn't been this way for a while, mm-hmm. as Peter Beinart mm-hmm. points out in his book, Crisis of Zionism. Right. The ADL actually has a history of being anti-discrimination, period,
right.
within the U.S. borders.
Right.
But aside from that, I think it's really, I think it was Michael Ben-Ari, the representative of the National United Party, who said, it was either him or maybe Eli Yishai. If only I could look at my notes, I would know. But it was one of those people referred to the Africans in South Tel Aviv as a threat to the Zionist entity. And an enemy within. And I think that despite that kind of hyperbole, it's pretty clear both to Israelis of all stripes and to American Jews on this side that they're not that. Mm-hmm. They are not an existential. There's 60,000 of them. That's a huge number, given that Israel is only 7 million people, right? That's a huge number. But they're not an existential threat to the state.
Right.
They don't want to be an existential threat to the state. There's no, there's no African immigrant covenant calling for whatever, right?
Right.
So regarding the Palestinians, I do understand that it is much, much harder for people to remove their own fears and their own concerns for their own people and their own family and even themselves from the conversation and say, right, these things have been said, but we're in a state of war. We have been for X number of years. Mm-hmm. How can we find a place in the middle? How can we treat these people who have been dehumanizing us and we have been dehumanizing them for X number of decades? How can we find a way to see them as human and meet and agree that they have needs that must be met? That's a much, much bigger question than
right.
should people be beating up on these 60,000 Africans who came here because they were hungry?
Right.
Well,
let's talk about another recent post that you've written about Jerusalem Day. You say, and you draw on an editorial that was in Haaretz, mm-hmm. about it being built on lies.
Right. The Jerusalem Day as a holiday is built on lies.
And those being?
Well, there's this notion that Jerusalem is the eternal undivided capital of the Jewish people, right. quote unquote. Right. Right. And in the sense of municipality boundaries, I can't speak to eternal. I'm not going to try to speak to eternal, right. but I will speak to undivided. You know, there is a line that's drawn around a certain amount of land that is no longer officially divided. But there's the fact that it is divided on all other fronts, socially, religiously, economically. I was just looking at some figures this morning as I was getting ready to chat with you today that, if you consider just the population figures, there's about 62 to 65% Jews in Jerusalem and 35 to 38% Palestinians, somewhere in that vicinity. But in terms of things like sewer lines and much more pleasant things like parks and public amenities,
infrastructure, yeah,
fully 90% or more. 90% or more of the budget for these things in Jerusalem goes to the Jewish community, not the Palestinian community, which makes up some 38% of the community and has to make do with 10 or less percent of the budget in these areas and in a lot of other areas as well. So there are enormous divisions. But then there's also just the historical fact that Jerusalem, as captured in 1967, was a very, very different animal than it is today. Mm-hmm. Immediately following the 67 war, the Six-Day War, the Jerusalem municipality was expanded tenfold to include Palestinian neighborhoods and villages that had never been, ever historically right. considered part of the city of Jerusalem. Right. And that expansion has not stopped. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, and you know, you've got these settlements. The thing I mentioned in the open Zion piece was when we pray to Jerusalem, as I do, you know, I turn to pray when I daven, I turn to pray to Jerusalem. I'm not praying to Pisgat Ze'ev, a settlement neighborhood that was built after 67. Mm-hmm. I'm not praying to those Palestinian neighborhoods that were annexed unilaterally after 67, and I'm not even praying to Jewish Jerusalem as it was in 1967, because that's a modern construct. I'm praying toward the Temple Mount, which is what is discussed in our scripture. So if you want to say that our center as a people is that location, I have no argument with you. And Israelis and Palestinians will have to figure out a way to share the Temple Mount. No question. And the Old City. No question. But you're going to tell me that Pisgat Ze'ev and, you know, Isawiya and Sheikh Jarrah and Har Homa are as holy to us as a people as the Temple Mount? I actually find it offensive. It strikes me as a kind of an idolatry that is both ahistorical and has nothing to do with my faith.
So since being back in the United States, when you, if you were to have this very conversation with perhaps someone who's not as aligned with your point of view as I might be,
right?
What kind of reactions do you get? Because do you feel like people even know what you're talking about? Do you feel like people are even thinking about it in these terms? Or what, you know, do you discuss this with people at your synagogue? What kind of reaction do you get if you were to have that conversation with them?
Well, the funny thing about me, given my day gig, is I actually really do not like confrontation. I feel very uncomfortable with, you know, some people really relish the argument, right?
Yes. But, you know, you've positioned yourself as a, right. I hate to use this term, an evangelist of sorts.
Right. Right. Well, I'm an activist. Yeah. I'm an advocate. And I can tell you there are a couple of different answers to your questions. first of all, when I started writing about this stuff on the op-ed pages of American newspapers in about 2002, mm-hmm. I had just graduated from the University of Chicago with my master's degree in Middle Eastern Studies. The Second Intifada was raging on in the wake of Ariel Sharon's visit to the Temple Mount in September 2001.
Provocative.
It was all, very provocative visit. They're all horrible, terrible. My husband and I are agonizing together and apart about what we should do with our future. I start writing about this because that's what I do. And I got a lot. Well, I got a mixed bag of responses. Let's be honest. Some of it was very positive. Some of it was literally people whispering to me in hallways, thank you so much for saying what I've been feeling. Mm-hmm. I got some letters from people who said that they had lost all faith in the entire Zionist project, and hearing from someone like me had allowed them to reconsider. But I'd say about 2/3 of the response was really, really serious pushback. And I got a death threat, and I got a letter sent around to the membership of my entire synagogue, accusing me of being a fifth column and all manner of terrible things. And people stopped talking to me, and people stopped talking to my kid, who was a toddler and was adorable. How can you not talk to him? And so there was a lot of that for a few years. That has lessened. But in the framework of I don't like confrontation, mm-hmm. I have never gone out of my way to talk about this with people in synagogue mm-hmm. or in synagogue circumstances, because right. we're not there to fight.
For that, right.
Right. And I don't enter into conversation with people who I know are merely looking for the argument.
Mm-hmm. But do you know,
go ahead.
Do people that you know through your synagogue circles or otherwise,
right.
you got to figure they're reading what you're writing?
Right, right. So there have been cases where I tend to, when I write, here's perhaps a more useful answer. When I write, I tend to be more sharp and more on point.
Mm-hmm. Than in
and when I am speaking with someone in a personal circumstance, and I know that they're thinking about themselves and their family. They're not thinking about something abstract. I tend to speak more carefully and with more caveats. Of course, you also have more space in a conversation. You're not limited in your words.
Right.
Because you don't, you know, there's that famous line that I think is from the fearful, now I can't remember his name. His initials are SA, and I keep wanting to say Sheldon Adelson, but he's a different guy altogether.
Yeah, I'm thinking.
There's a statement about community organizing that you can't organize people where you want them to be. You can only organize them where they are. I'm more than happy. I acknowledge people come at this from all kinds of different places, mm-hmm. and a lot of it is informed by fear, and a lot of it is informed by worry that's genuine. Who am I to tell them to not be scared, right? All I can tell them is what I've learned mm-hmm. in response to that fear.
Because mm-hmm. I feel like there's a lot, you know, especially on the, you know, online, there's a kind of a tendency for these sorts of conversations. And I've had this conversation before on Blogging Heads with other people mm-hmm. like Sarah Wildman. You know, how do you prevent it from devolving into just the, you know, just an accusation? Well, you know, this obviously means that you must hate Israel, or you must
right.
be...
Right.
You know, whatever
well,
I draw this conclusion
instance,
about you because of this,
accused...
as opposed to sorting out why do those fears exist? Why mm-hmm. do you have these certain, why your perceptions have been shaped in a certain way? And is it possible to reshape your perception based on realities that are happening that maybe you haven't fully informed yourself of or have been fully informed of? You know, I guess I kind of long for those sorts of conversations because I feel like these so frequently just devolve into, oh, well, you know, I've drawn this conclusion about you and you must be anti this or pro that or whatever.
Right.
And we can't converse about this anymore. And I don't believe the reality that you're setting out because I believe this other reality and therefore we can't talk about it.
Well, just yesterday, Right. Okay. So just yesterday, I was accused on my own blog of defending the right of Palestinians to kill Israelis which of course I have never done, never will do, never have done.
Right.
Death, murder, war, terrible things. In fact, my entire career is predicated on the notion that we really had, would be better off if we stopped killing each other. But what I do, it's, I do kind of a combination of things. I don't actually read the comics, the comments. Sorry, I do read the comics. I don't read the comments
on Open your blog
Zion.
Or on Open Zion. Okay.
I don't read them on Open Zion mm-hmm. because while I'm absolutely confident that there are a lot of people saying really smart things there on both sides of the argument, right? And a lot of people really trying to direct the conversation in a wise and useful way. I know for a fact that there are always a good few who do not do that. And I just can't hack it anymore. I don't want to have to wade my way through them and respond to that kind of hate and then carry that kind of hate around inside me for the rest of the day.
Yeah.
At my own blog and on Twitter, I have, and this is what stops me from engaging on Open Zion, on my own blog and on Twitter, I have a much greater degree of control, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not the moderator at Open Zion. On my own blog and on my Twitter account, I am the moderator. So what I try to do is say, look, I'm happy to have disagreements, but they have to be polite. They have to not be hateful. They can't be straight up bigoted. You know, you can be as polite as you want to and say that the Palestinians are animals and I'm going to ban you, right? I mean, there's no polite way to say that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's been said on my blog. But I really, really try in my own teeny tiny little corner and in my own teeny tiny little way to, I don't know, maybe curate in a way that allows us to not treat each other badly. I don't want to scream at anybody. Don't scream at me. I don't want to accuse you of wishing death on people or of being inhuman. Don't accuse me of the same. Let's use words that we would use in each other's presence. So, you know, it's an uphill battle, but it's kind of all I can do. And so I stick to it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that answers your question in any reasonable way.
So obviously these conversations do have an unfortunate tendency to devolve into that sort of diatribe.
Right.
But then on the other hand, it's important to document, I think, as you have been, changes in Israeli society and Israeli mm-hmm. politicians and the politicians who get elected to the Knesset, in this more troubling, right-wing racist direction.
Right. It's
do you get the sense that American Jews are listening to that? That's getting absorbed as something that's actually happening. You know, that people understand that's happening.
I don't really think it is, but
why?
I'm going to frame that with the fact that this is a sense I have,
mm-hmm.
not something that I can show you research for,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Mm-hmm.
My sense is that, writ large, the American Jewish people are like any other people. They care about one or two things more than others.
Mm-hmm.
They know a little bit about them. They know where to find out more. They form opinions, and then they move forward. And my sense is that most American Jews are not able to follow Israeli politics very closely because they don't know the ins and outs, because who can follow it? Because it's crazy.
Yep, there's that.
And I, you know, I completely agree. I had to look up last night. I had to look up, wait a minute, what's Mikhail Ben-Ari's party? It's National Unity, but who's it made up of again?
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. It's
right.
Four different parties, some of which didn't exist, you know, 5 years ago.
Right, right.
And now they formed, they're a different party, right? So I think that to some degree, the uglier side of Israeli politics in terms of anti-democratic and and discriminatory practices that have been slowly but surely really rolling out since 2010, and actually not all that slowly,
mm-hmm.
definitely surely. I'm not sure that the American Jewish community writ large is really as painfully aware of that as they are of the fact that, say, That soldier hit a Danish protester in the face with a rifle butt, and people are saying that the IDF isn't the most moral army in the universe anymore, right? There's this way that we have of reacting to Israel, of reading about Israel, of talking about Israel. We have a pattern, we have a system. And to start thinking about a new piece of it is not always that easy. And my impression is that not a lot of people are thinking about it as closely as I wish they were.
I mean, do you think that that's a function of just not even having a place to receive the information?
That's part of it. I mean, honestly, there's how much can you write about Israel? Even if, I mean, a lot of people talk about how, oh, this isn't in the press and that isn't in the press and that should be in the press.
Right.
The press has a whole world to cover. You know, there's a whole lot of stuff going on in China, too, I'm given to understand. Right. So there is a level at which even if you're genuinely interested, but you have a normal life and you have to do the laundry and pick up the kids and go to work and make dinner.
And understand the politics in your own community.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Which takes time.
Now, and this is a great place for me to give props to 972 blog.
Right.
Which if you are an English speaker who wants to know more about what's going on, that's a really, really great source. And it's 972. That's the country code. If you're dialing Israel, that's what you have to dial.
Right.
So
right.
I love that. Yeah. But, that's a great source, but you have to seek these things out. Mm-hmm. They're not going to land on your doorstep or in your, you know, RSS feed.
Well, unless you put it there, right?
Right. But then you have to know to look for it and you're busy doing the laundry and going to some APAC meeting and, you know.
Well, okay. Well, then that's going to counteract that, right?
Right. Exactly.
So I guess the other question that I have, like, I feel like, At my own synagogue, which is a Reform synagogue, not conservative like yours, that this doesn't get discussed at all, really. Very rarely. Occasionally my rabbi will bring up the ultra-Orthodox terrible treatment of women in Israel, which has been going on and has been in the news a bit. But I feel like that it's almost like it conflicts too much with the narrative that we have been educated to believe about Israel, that it's
There's
wonderful,
something,
it's a democracy, and et cetera, et cetera. And it's
increasingly
becoming
pictures
not a democracy. It's becoming a place where, you know, the government has tried to crack down on pro-peace groups and, you know, the continuing occupation, obviously.
Well, I would say here's what I would say. I would say that Israel, again, I'm going to borrow a little bit from my boss, from Peter Beinart. Israel is a democracy within its green line. Beyond the green line, it's not, but I'm not going to talk about that right now because we're talking about within the green line. It's a democracy under siege, right? It's a democracy that is battling for its life, but it's battling for its life because it is a democracy. There are laws and systems in place that people can appeal to, you know, laws can be appealed and repealed, and the rule of law is still expected, and it's a troubled democracy, like I think most democracies ultimately are, because I don't think people are... Go ahead.
But you were so troubled by it that you didn't want to raise your kids there.
It wasn't the democracy. It was the lack of democracy on the other side of the green line. Uh-huh. It was the conflict. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to raise my kids to be sacrificed in a literal or metaphorical sense on the altar of the occupation.
Right.
It's really hard. I can understand why people don't like drawing that distinction, because it's a really difficult distinction to draw. Oh yeah, it's, you know, there are nice laws in place if you're on this side of the line, but if you're on the other side of the line, and that absolutely matters. But that's exactly why it's in trouble, not non-existent, if you see what I mean.
No, I do see what you mean. But so do you think it's conceivable in your lifetime that you would go back?
I did when we made the decision. Mm-hmm. We said for the time being, mm-hmm. that was how we put it.
But that was 14 years ago.
You know, but to the extent that the conflict and the occupation and the settlement enterprise have changed, they've only gotten worse. You know, mm-hmm. the Palestinians and Israelis are farther, I think, from achieving resolution to the conflict now than they were in September 2001 when Sharon went up on the Temple Mount. And I would argue that's why he went up there. Mm-hmm. Because he didn't want to see a two-state solution, mm-hmm. and he was in the business of provoking behavior on all sides that would keep that from happening. I never say never. You know, what has been put up by human hands can be taken down by human hands. Mm-hmm. The wall, the settlements, the roads, they're not divine, but they're awful big. And we're at a stage where the country really is, to my mind, wholly dedicated to protecting the occupation and the settlements. Mm-hmm. And at this point, you know, I have a nearly 13-year-old, a nearly 8-year-old. Mm-hmm. They're American. Mm-hmm. They feel very much at home in Israel. They speak a lot of Hebrew at home. They visit a lot. They feel it's their second home. But this is where their lives are, and that place just keeps going downhill. So no, I don't see us moving back. And I have to say that that makes me incredibly sad when I say that. But that's the facts.
Well, is that a good place to end it, do you think?
I don't
or
know.
Would you rather end on a more...
That's awfully... Is there a good place to end it? There's never a good place to end this conversation. But well, I think it's a reasonable place.
Do you feel positive, at least, about the prospects of Open Zion changing some conversations?
I do. And I think that that has tremendous value unto itself. I think that it really matters. I think that honesty matters. I think that people having open conversation matters, even if the end result is not what we might have wanted, even if, and this is my fear. My fear is that the Zionist dream will die on the sword of the settlements, and some horrible series of years will follow, and we will look back on Israel as yet another Jewish disaster that could have been prevented. In this case, other Jewish disasters maybe we couldn't have prevented, mm-hmm. but this one we could have prevented. Mm-hmm. But even if that horrible outcome is what happens, and please God it's not, there's still tremendous value to the communities talking and being honest about it, about what's going on, and being able to say what they truly believe and what they truly see. And I think that what Peter's piece in the New York Review of Books in 2010, and then the reactions to that, and also I have to give props to the formation of J Street, and even before the formation of Brit Tzedek V'Shalom, the Jewish mm-hmm. Alliance for Justice and Peace. So these two organizations, then Peter's seminal piece in the New York Review of Books, then the book. Next 2 years that followed mm-hmm. Of discussion, and then his new book, which is an expansion on the ideas in that piece, mm-hmm. and Open Zion is an expansion of the ideas that he's bringing up in the book. The reactions to it are so strong. And they're really, really strong from the right.
And from the left.
Yeah, this is it. Is you hear so many people saying, from writers with Rolling Stone to writers at the new, you know, to Paul Krugman, to Dana Goldstein, to all these people who are not unfamiliar with taking on controversial topics, right? They're people who've been in the mix for years saying, oh my God, thank God someone said something, because I didn't want to, because it was too much of a hassle.
And I felt alone,
Right. And I felt alone. But there are all these people out there who are now saying, oh, guess what? I'm not alone, mm-hmm. which was a reaction that I've been getting for about 10 years, but I'm not nearly as big a personage, right? So, oh, thank God I'm not alone. And they're saying it on the national stage. So I think that people are now going to be able to say more honestly what's been going on for them within the community vis-a-vis Israel. And I think that has tremendous value, and I think it's really, really worth, it's a really worthwhile exercise, I think.
Well, Okay, at least I got you to end not on a complete
There you go.
downer. So, okay, well, listen, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Sarah. I really appreciate it.
Bye, Emily.
Bye.